Hello, this is Josh Carr at The Real Angle, and today I've got a bunch of people from Montgomery Partners. So let's start with the basics. Let's do some introductions. Let's talk about what Montgomery does, and then we'll kind of go from there. Spencer, you want to kick us off?
Fantastic. Well, as Josh said, my name is Spencer Palmer. I'm the Vice President of Investments. Montgomery Partners is a quasi-family office and syndication group. We were founded in the early 1980s by my father, John Palmer. I myself am in charge of the investments. I underwrite the deals. I will travel to new markets, source all of them, do the underwriting, source the debt as well, before I pass it off to my brother-in-arms, Brady Badger.
There we go.
Hi, Brady. Josh, thanks for helping us on. So Brady Badger, I sort of take the baton from Spencer and run the fundraising side for the company, as well as client relations and sort of managing the day-to-day, needs of the client. But once we've gotten to that point, we've raised the money, we've closed the deal, then it's really on to our other brother-in-arms, Brady Stern. And yes, there are two Bradys in our company, and it does get confusing, so we apologize
for
that.
So do you do Brady B and Brader S, or do you have like
from the Animal House? Yeah, so it's usually Brady B, Brady S, or it's BB, BS, or it's, I don't know. We call each other by our last name, our first name.
It never gets confusing, so we really don't have to delineate.
There we go. No, you need to do what they did in the movie Animal House. You need like frat brother names, like call one of them.
we're working on that.
Yeah, no, that's really, you can tell I'm definitely a product of another generation where I'm like, we should have frat brother names. That would be a good inclusive environment in the workplace. So good stuff. Anyway, nonetheless. Yeah,
2 minutes in, it didn't take long to hit on the National Lampoons.
I'm doing what I can. It's a classic, and there's nothing wrong with that movie. But nonetheless, so then it moves over to Brady Stern, and Brady Stern, you do like asset management, essentially.
Correct. Yeah, I serve as chief operating officer at Montgomery Partners, head asset management and property management here as well. I've been here about 2.5 years now. Bring past investment real estate experience from UBS on the institutional side and Carmel Partners on the development side. And just a personal anecdote with Josh, my Columbia colleagues in the past have all spoke highly of the famous Josh Carr, and I was excited for the opportunity about 10 years ago to go to New York for a week and take your financial modeling class, and that was really the genesis for this relationship.
Well, there we go. Thank you very much. I appreciate it when someone else can plug me rather than myself. So that's good. Thank you. Nonetheless, it's always appreciated. So let's talk about what Montgomery Partners does, just from a market standpoint, a product type standpoint. What do you guys buy and what markets are you in?
Of course, I'll take this one. We're sure. Long-term value add investors. I'd say our average hold time is 5 to 7 years. We play in the multifamily value add space. I'd say our markets right now that we're really focused and very bullish on is kind of the Denver West space. We currently own and operate in California, Colorado, and Nevada, although we're actively bidding on deals in Utah, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. I'd say our thesis is, the C-plus to B-plus space, kind of that upper workforce housing. 50 okay. to about 200 units is kind of our sweet spot. Anywhere from 10 to kind of 45 million is the kind of the total deal size for us. Again, our goal is to bring kind of that lower quality deal. So that's that C-plus, B-minus deal in a great neighborhood up to a B-plus level. And we're going to do that through an active interior and exterior kind of renovation play, renovating okay. anywhere from half to three quarter of the interior units and doing a massive exterior play as well, typically adding common area amenities, doing deferred maintenance as soon as we can, the typical kind of strategy there. I think what differentiates us from other groups right now is the longer term strategy. I think a lot of people got really used to the quick flip model over the last couple of years, the kind of 2 and 3 years.
Sure.
We tried to always be in that 5, 7 and kind of 10 year category. We're oftentimes doing, fixed rate debt throughout the entirety, oftentimes interest only, although we have taken some loans with a bit of a hybrid there. And that's mainly coming through agency relationships and banks. We're big believers in, you buy a really quality asset at a great basis and you hold for long term and really continue to add value there as best we can.
So let me zoom in a little bit on the market thing. Like, what if you had to pick one market right now that you're really hot on, and one market that maybe you were cold on? Which market are you loving? Which market are you loving less?
That's a great question. You know, I think there's been a ton of development in a lot of these markets that saw amazing rent growth. You can look at Raleigh, Phoenix, Denver's a great one, Salt Lake City, Boise. These are markets we were very, very bullish on and still are, you know, over, and will be over the next couple of years. But I think we need to kind of work through that glut of development that's happening. You know, there's more deliveries coming forth in 2024 than there were in 2023. And we have not seen this number of deliveries happen since kind of the mid to late 80s. So I think a lot of that needs to get worked through. Now, I believe those markets have the demand for it, which is something that not a lot of people are talking about right now, and they will sustain it. But I think there will be a concession game that kind of that's played there. So that's kind of the markets I'm not as hot on as I was, but I still want to continue to look at and watch. I think a bit of a contrarian view right now is that we are dipping our toe back into California, which is where we've been, you know, focused for the last, you know, 40 years. I think California kind of got a bad rap for, you know, a number of reasons, whether it be, you know, political issues or the inability to build. But because of that, you know, everyone saw during the pandemic, every deal across the country basically go to a 3.5 cap, right? And the rental story was there because they were basically catching up to what the national average could be. But if you look back at California, you know, we've seen very, very steady rent growth in a lot of these markets, and it's very, very difficult to build it. So, yeah. You know, we're digging back into both Northern and Southern California, as well as Central California, much more so than I think we were a couple of years ago.
Interesting. No, it's always fun to ask people. I mean, the question about, you know, long-term rent growth, I mean, definitely a lot of people are chatting now about, well, there's huge amounts of supply, and is that oversupply? And at the same time, you know, there seems to be an amazing amount of young people who are basically still living at their parents' houses looking for that first place. There's a lot of pent up demand for housing. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, which wins out on that conversation.
Not only that, I think the sentiment has really shifted too with the younger generations, both millennial and Gen Zs, where the affordability component of owning your own home versus renting, you know, there's never been a wider gap. So I think it's been, what happened was for a long time, there was this renter by necessity category and there was a renter by choice. And I think what's happening now is that renter by choice category is growing a lot larger than anybody really expected. And because of that, to your point, a lot of the supply will be eaten up and frankly taken over by these younger generations who are choosing to know what their monthly, you know, cost is going to be with rent versus having unexpected costs and a mortgage to pay. You know, the freedom to choose and move now so is more evident than it's ever been before.
No, and the freedom of move is an interesting thing. I mean, you're younger. I kid around that the younger generation is the Netflix generation, and that they want everything on a monthly subscription, and they want to be able to cancel everything at a moment's notice, like just everything.
Yeah.
You know, which is, for someone who's of a different generation, I'm always like, well, you have to live somewhere, so buy a house. Whereas the earlier generation is like, no, what if I want to, like, move to the East Coast tomorrow? And it's like, yeah, but you're not going to. But yet they want that flexibility, and they'll pay for that flexibility. So it's interesting to me. It's interesting.
Sure.
Yeah, there's definitely been an evolution, and I think it'll be curious to see what the one bedroom, two bedroom mix looks down the road, because as people increasingly are putting off, you know, settling down, having kids longer, unit mix is going to be part of the conversation too. But nonetheless, so markets, we talked about markets you're hot on. You're into residential. You're not doing anything else. No retail, no office. It's really a pure resi strategy is what you guys have done.
Correct. Yep.
Now I guess this is a question more for Brady from a money-raising side, unless I'm incorrect. Most of the equity you bring in is sort of traditional syndication. You're raising money from limited partners, from a pool of people. Do you like the fact that you're giving them consistent apartment assets, right? That's kind of what the feed is, if you will. Like,
yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I guess the question is just, I mean, because I've done syndication myself. Do you ever have investors who are like, hey, do you have anything else? Like, I'm sick of doing apartment deals in Denver. Like, what else do you have? Or are they really, the fact that they're getting consistency out of you?
I would say, generally speaking, people come to us because they know that we, for 40 years, have been buying and selling apartments and we've done well doing that. And so there is that sort of tradition or track record, rather, that has kept our 300 or so high net worth individuals and families in our stable consistently coming back and re-upping for the next one. That doesn't mean that there aren't people who ask us, hey, are you doing industrial, or hey, are you doing self-storage, or whatever it might be? Are you dipping your toes into office market in San Francisco because, you know, there's big discounts?
They read the paper.
they're paying attention to the news. You know, I think we're very cognizant of what we're good at and what we know we can execute on. And I think a big piece of that is, again, I'll reiterate it again, is that we've been around for 40 years. You know, it's like John, our founder, Spencer's father, has, and our other general partner, Mike Pirro, have done a fantastic job at helping to keep the ship going straight. You know, I mean, really making sure that we deliver regularly to our investors doesn't mean we haven't had our challenges. Doesn't mean we haven't had a few investments not go do as well as we would like.
It's 40 years. Things are going to go wrong. Sure.
You're going to have a few singles, right? I mean, or a few strikeouts, but generally speaking, we come around to home base. And so that's really, you know, what we try to continue to do, even as we look to expand in other markets.
What I'm also hearing, and maybe I'm reading between the lines too, is that, you know, part of it is also about just operational issues. And by that, I mean, it's more than just you do a deal, you do another deal. It's also because you've been doing it for 40 years. It's an operating business. Like, people a lot of times in our industry, I think, underappreciate that it's more than just doing a deal. It's like, no, you're building a franchise, a business. You have relationships. There's a machine, which is more than just we own some buildings. And it sounds like that's what you're kind of addressing there too.
It's interesting. It really is. It really comes down to the day in and day out. And I think that's where Brady Stern really comes into the fold, is his side of the business. And I'll let him talk, but it's, you know, if we can't execute on the operations, then we're not doing our job. We're not going to have the returns, and we're not going to have the repeat investor clients. So
I guess Brady, I'll throw it over to other Brady just to talk a little bit about operational stuff. Like, what's the life of the operator look like these days? I didn't realize that's kind of a broad question.
It's increasingly challenging, for sure. I'd love to say there's some secret sauce that differentiates Montgomery Partners from our competitors, but at the end of the day, I think it really boils down to what's our experience and what are the relationships that we have. Brady mentioned and touched on it. We've been syndicating deals for 40 years and have this great track record. What does that look like on the operations side? So we have in-house property management within California, and we have third-party property management from both AMC and FPI out of state. So it's a formula that works pretty well for us. Getting a little bit into the weeds on the operations side, it's tough right now. It's a tough climate. We're anticipating market rent growth somewhere between being flat, maybe 2% on an upside scenario this next year. As we get through oncoming supply, need to get that absorbed before we can start pushing again. But that gets outweighed on the expense side by operating in an inflationary environment. Everything's more expensive. Insurance is more expensive. We're seeing increases of 2 to 3x on some properties. The labor market's really tight. Hiring for both front of house, back of house staff, and then contracting repair folks. Anytime you need to get a plumber, an electrician, a painter, any vendor out, there's just so much demand for their services right now. That we're scratching and clawing trying to keep NOI stable in 2024 on some of these properties. But
yeah, no one's going into the trades. I mean, I saw an interesting article was talking about the projected growth of solar, and someone was just doing the math. The obvious statement, which is, well, if you're going to put all these solar panels on, you're going to need a lot of electricians. We don't physically have enough electricians to do the work. So now what, you know, and you can't just training an electrician is not like a gas station attendant. I mean, it takes some skill and some training before you should be doing that kind of job.
I try and differentiate what are Montgomery Partners specific problems and what are industry general problems. These are, you know, problems that everyone in the industry is facing. I think what differentiates us a little bit is just on the relationship side. Having these long-standing ties to general contractors and property managers and, you know, brokers, investors, lenders, that's something that really differentiates us and serves us well.
They return your call first. Sure.
Probably the best example of a moat that I can point to from, you know, what we're doing to someone that's just starting out in the industry.
So I guess here's a question I always like to ask, which is on a recent deal, and this could either be an acquisitions issue or an operations issue. Surprises, good or bad, things never go as expected. Sometimes you unexpectedly have happy accidents. Sometimes you have a mess. Any good recent surprises that we've encountered, either from an operational standpoint or a deal standpoint?
Sure, and I think this would be a good one to talk about with Nueva Vista and Palms, kind of how that kind of that deal came together, and you know how we've been approaching it, just because that's a very unique purchase compared to what we've done in the past.
Sure. I guess two acquisitions that we can spotlight from 2023 this past year. First one, 74 units, fully marketed in Santa Rosa, California. Santa Rosa, just by way of perspective, is the largest city between San Francisco and Portland, and where we have pretty great presence with five or six current holdings there. We acquired this property that had about half of the units vacant. And there was a fire and a flood from the previous ownership, and they hadn't backfilled the units, released the units. So for us,
sorry,
really
a fire and a flood? Was that?
Just
was this one event? Like they had a fire and they flooded it? Like, do you mean the fire department flooded it, or like just?
Yeah, two separate events, I believe, but it's not often, you know, you can acquire a property like that with 50% vacancy. And for us, you know, that just screams upside on getting to get in there and renovate the units and really aggressively reposition it, which you don't find very often. One of our challenges is just being able to, you know, renovate the units timely when you've got pretty high retention rates from residents. So we were able to get in there over the course of 5 or 6 months, renovate about 30 of the units, in addition to some common area heavy lifting. So we felt pretty good about that one. But probably the biggest surprise is the counter to that with some of the other acquisitions that we've had recently, just not seeing as many move outs as we've seen historically. Our retention rate's probably closer to 70%, where I think of industry average being closer to 55%. So, you know, it's great if you can send out. Yeah, it's great if you can send out. Yeah. It's hard to say. I think part of it's probably we're limited on the increases that we can send out in California with AB 1482. In most markets in California, it's 5% plus CPI. So it's not unlimited.
You can't just go to market. Sure.
You can't go to market. So, right. You know, if the downside of that is we send out renewals of, you know, 8 to 10% and people take them, we're not having to do any of the renovation work, then that's not the worst case scenario. It's not the worst thing to happen to us.
That makes sense. No, the availability of units, again, I mean, there's a huge amount of supply coming down the pipeline, and it's going to be interesting to see what it hits. And it's going to hit different markets differently. I mean, just because that's the nature of the beast. Well, that's interesting. So, you know, the market for the last year has been challenging, I guess would be a good way of putting it. Interest rates have been bouncing all over the place. You know, the bid-ask spread is wider than I've seen in quite some time in terms of, you know, cap rates that people are asking versus where things are settling at. I mean, I know personally I've got a deal in the market right now, and I'm getting very different answers on value from a lender, from potential buyers, from the tax appeal person. What's your sense of, like 23 is in the rearview mirror. What does 2024 look like? What are you guys thinking of for 2024?
I think it's kind of a two-part answer because I think there's different strategies for us versus other people. I think overall, okay, we're very bullish on 2024. You know, I think the deals we're seeing and that are penciling right now, like we're chasing a couple off-market portfolios ourselves. And, you know, we haven't seen these kind of return metrics maybe at best since 2010, 2011. No. I mean, it's been a solid decade since then. So on that hand, you know, we're very bullish. You know, I think you have to contrast that view with the fact that I'm not entirely sure we're going to miss a recession here. You know, I think, you know, not to put, you know, too much on the Fed, but they're always a little slow to react. And, you know, they were slow to put the brakes on. And if you look at certain indices, you know, we're already below that 2 or 3% threshold right now, even though, you know, the new CPI print came out today and said, hey, you know, it's going up. Like, well, rear view looking, but sure. Okay, we can talk about that another time. Right. But, you know, I think they're going to be slow to take the brakes off as well. And because of that, you know, we could be in a situation where we find ourselves seeing the employment rate go up. And, you know, if we're looking at where the employment rate is right now, we're back to like 3.7, 3.8. You know, if you look at where labor participation was, you know, 2 to 3 years ago, if you use those numbers, you know, we're between 4 and 5%. So we've seen it go up a considerable amount. We're not necessarily giving that much of the conversation the credit it deserves. And for groups like ours who play in that C plus to kind of B plus space and the upper workforce housing and that renter by necessity category, you know, we're very aware of what's happening with the unemployment and frankly, where wage and job growth is. We have to be. So, you know, contrasting the two, you know, there's gonna be a lot of deliveries in 2024 for this new construction deals where they just don't pencil and the takeouts won't work. So we need to go to the market, either bring in a, you know, a new joint venture partnership to take them out, a pref equity slice, or they might just need to sell it at a loss. So when you look at these deals, 2024 and 2025, look to have everything we're talking about in terms of putting the foot back on the gas. But again, from our perspective, because we hold long-term, you know, if we can get a deal to pencil now with fixed rate loans with interest only and, you know, moderate leverage levels between 55 and 65%, you know, we're going to chase those deals all day long. But I think there's going to be a lot of competition for the newer stuff. So I think looking between 80s, 90s, and early 2000s vintage is going to be very fruitful for us over the next 5 to 10 years.
So follow-up question, because you talk about like, you know, these guys are going to have a list of options, right? They could sell it. They could, as you said, bring in a partner, pref equity position, what have you. And I know traditionally your business model has been you just buy the buildings, get fixed rate debt. Have you considered, or are you open to doing stuff that's more like, hey, maybe we will take an equity piece. Maybe we will come in as a joint venture guy. Or are you really looking to just do straight fee, simple real estate?
We're looking at every option right now. I mean, we've never bought new construction. We haven't played in the JV space, but we are creating those JV relationships. You know, I think it's going to be just where is the best use of capital. I think one thing we can all acknowledge is that capital has become very agnostic over the last 10 to 20 years. You know, I think there was a slice of people that really understood real estate, and that's where they played. And there's people that understood stocks and bonds, that's where they played. But now with the math being what it is, you can correlate those two very easily and say, hey, where's my best return, both with and without the tax advantages? So I think from our perspective, there's going to be opportunities to play in that JV space, in that pref space, and participate in some of these raises and go in with funds and do, you know, different investment projects we haven't looked at before. But I think our bread and butter is continue to be buy and operate deals that we own ourselves. And maybe we bring in, you know, a JV partner or a large co-JP to do that with us.
Rather than build like a high yield debt fund and have that be a whole different business model that you get into.
Correct.
Yeah. And look, and I think that's always an interesting question. Like, you know, it sort of gets back to the, you could do a one-off thing, but you, if you're going to do it, you want it to be a strategy and really grow it rather than just some random one-off deal. And that gets back to, I guess, also the job of raising money, which is you have a track record of you do one thing really, really well. So you don't want to just sort of throw out random ideas and see if it'll work.
Right. And I think that's also where, you know, Spencer mentioned just sort of the, how we're kind of looking at different options. And we really have been spending a lot of time on, because people are sort of agnostic, as long as they can invest in real estate, whether that's, you know, with us and, you know, sort of as a GP in a syndicated deal, or that's, you know, in REITs, everyone kind of knows they need to have a real estate allocation as part of their overall net worth or their pie, if you will. And what we're trying to tap into is really building on that 300 plus, you know, client base that we have. And that may be with some strategic partnerships, whether they're joint venture or, you know, simply, you know, a family office that decides they want to start investing with us, or a co-GP situation. But we're open to those ideas and we frankly welcome them, because that's what's going to allow us to push the envelope a little bit and keep growing the way we would like to and go into these markets that we've been talking about. Right. Because at some point you can only go to your existing clientele so many times over a certain number of years. Eventually they start saying, I don't have any more checks to write right now. And so, and fortunately we're not there. Yeah, exactly. Like, fortunately we're not there, but we know that you have to replenish and you kind of have to refresh the water. And build on it. And that's what we're trying to do now.
No, and look, what you're doing is admirable. I mean, this is the right way of doing it. You know, I mean, there are a lot of guys out there who, you know, I don't want to beat up on the crowdfunding people too much, but, you know, there's other ways to raise money. You definitely are doing it the more traditional way, where you're building relationships over long term, rather than lots of little guys with lots of little checks and that sort of thing. No, it's curious. So, Look, I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about the macroeconomics. I guess a couple other questions I have, just, and this is just my own personal curiosity. You know, I know you guys do a lot of stuff in California. You know, solar continues to be in the news, and I know I mentioned it just in passing about electricians and shortages and that sort of thing. And we also talking about expenses going up a lot. Is that something that you guys have gotten into, or is that something that hasn't happened yet for you guys? Because it seems like everyone's putting solar on their roofs all over the darn place.
It's happening all over. Yeah, we're always looking for ancillary revenue opportunities, and I think you have to try and dig deeper in a market like this where expenses are going up and rent growth is flat. So what do ancillary opportunities look like? Solar is definitely one of them. EV charging, the parcel pending package lockers that you can charge back for. Anything and everything under the sun, I think we're evaluating. We don't have anything in our current portfolio right now, but I think that's probably the next box to check is trying to figure out solar. One that we've had
success
with.
Yeah, and the EV thing's interesting because, again, I mean, you know, penetration of EVs, California's been leading the market for EV charging penetration. But you guys probably, because you're more workforce product, you don't have people driving $100,000 Rivians all over the place, probably your property. So that's probably
Something we've talked about in recent months, and I think you're exactly right, Josh. You drive these properties, and they're not filled with the Teslas, the Rivians, the EVs. There's just not a lot of demand from our renter base right now, like there would be at, name whatever Class A property in the major urban markets.
For what it's worth, and I mean, we're recording this January 11th. Today's news, yesterday's news was, I guess, Hertz is dropping something like 20,000 low-cost Teslas to the market that they want to get off their portfolio. And I, for kicks, I pulled it up this morning, and I guess they're dumping Tesla Model 3s for like low $20,000 range, you know, so 20, 21 grand, you know, that's a working man's car. So just figured I'd ask. It's just in the
it's a good question. As Brady said, you know, it's something that the last couple of months we have started talking about, because as you just pointed out, the cost of owning an electric car is coming down dramatically just to buy, whether it's a used one or even a new one. And so those are, you know, like you said, $20,000-$25,000 is a working man's car. And they're going to be there at some point in the next few years. They're going to start saying, hey, I need to charge my car. And we actually, you know, it's timely because we actually have we're setting up a meeting with an infrastructure solar panel guy that we're supposed to talk to this next week. So, you know, it's something we're looking at, but, you know, we're not there yet, but we definitely want to understand what the market is and how and what ways it could generate additional revenue, as Brady pointed out, for the properties.
No, I like to ask these questions because, I mean, I keep seeing all these high level policy conversations among various political officials about what they want the future to look like. But at the end of the day, you guys actually have to implement. So, like, it's all fine and good for government folks to be like, we're doing this. And then it's like, yeah, but who's running the actual electrical line in the parking lot? Like, how do we actually physically get this done? It's not glamorous, but we got to do it.
Interestingly enough, California also can't get any more, you know, power in, right? It's got to be created somewhere because the grid is already at its maximum. You know, just as they went out and said, everyone's got to have an electric car by like 2035. I think 2 weeks later, they have the rolling blackouts. So, It's a great idea. I think California needs to get a little bit, you know, back behind, you know, the tip of the skis to figure out exactly how to implement this first. But no, I mean, I think the costs are coming down across the board, both the cars, the solar panels, and the technology itself. And as soon as that happens, the implementation will be kind of across the board.
Yeah, and it's fun. I mean, that's why I'm talking about this with you guys, because it's interesting, because real estate people, by our nature, we tend to be pretty conservative in our ways because it's a pretty straightforward business. But, you know, periodically the game changes and we need to evolve. Well, this is good. Look, we talked a little bit, and I guess my only other question was, your deals really, they're all kind of their own separate syndications. Like, each deal rises and falls on its own, and then you kind of have the operating business. And I guess here's the last question. This is for Brady Stern. You mentioned that you guys have a property management company, which is pretty active in California, and you manage your stuff. Have you expanded it into third-party management, or is it all sort of like you manage your own stuff and that's what you do?
Yeah, we have a pretty robust third-party property management company within California. So we self-manage within California. We have a regional manager in the Northern California. We have a regional manager specific to our San Francisco portfolio, and then another regional manager who's been with us for 20 years in Southern California.
But are you managing properties for other owners, or it's just you guys are managing your own stuff?
it's all self-managed.
All your own thing. Yeah.
Other owners are a pain in the ass to work for.
I know. we can be. I just figured I'd ask. Sure. It's and I don't think that's a wrong response. I think a lot of people when they get into third party management, they do it more as a way to see what owners want to get rid of stuff or something. And then
anyone that challenges that is lying to themselves.
Yeah. I just figured I'd ask. Yeah, I think also, especially with what you guys are doing, I mean, look, not to tell you what to do or what not to do, but especially with some of the workforce housing stuff where it's not a Class A product and it's local, it makes a lot of sense for you guys to, I'm going to sound like a Northeasterner, you know, say, you know, plow your own snow. I know that's not an issue for you, but that's the way I think of it is sort of do your own. You know, mow your own lawns, do it yourself. So that's good. That's good. Well, look, this is very, very constructive. I guess any closing thoughts on where we end up? I guess we talked a little bit about possible recession. We talked about supply. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to hit. I think we kind of worked through it. Any other thoughts? You good?
I mean, I think just kind of in closing and kind of where we think we're going, we're, as Spencer said, we are optimistic and bullish on this year and next year and the next coming years. But I would say that we're cautiously optimistic, right? I mean, we're very much, every day we kind of talk about what the headlines are and we kind of, we are following the interest rates, we are following the Fed. But that being said, we are seeing deals that pencil, we're seeing deals that make sense. And we're actively, in discussing raising funds, a lot of people have a lot of money sitting on the sides right now. The last 2 years, a lot of people just didn't invest when, they didn't have checks to write because they didn't want to risk the potential upswing in interest rates. So
I hear you. And they were getting 5%. Then they were getting 5% in a high yield savings account. So they just said, I'll make 5% with no risk, or I'll go with you guys and make, 10%.
Completely.
15,
that was sort of the second half of last year was, everyone said, well, I've already put my money at 5.5% in a CD and I can't touch it till next year. So call me next year, and so we're calling them, and we are reaching out to them and we're saying, hey, we are looking at stuff, keep your powder dry. Go ahead.
So I guess here's my question for you. And I guess last question, because this is an ongoing debate I've been having with a number of people in my network. When people jump back in, are you of the mindset that it will be like everyone all at once, or do you think it's going to like trickle out? Like, what do you think it's going to look like? Is this a tidal wave money turns on, or is this a 24-month type thing? If you had to bet,
I think once the spigot comes back on, I think once the spigot comes back on, it'll come on pretty quickly. But I think it'll take a couple big groups dipping their toes in. I mean, you saw True America make some really good trades. MG has made some really good trades in the past couple months. I mean, the bigger guys who see opportunity here have already dipped their toes back in, us included, buying two deals in 2023. I think. I don't want to say we found the bottom or passed it, but you never know when you're going to hit the bottom, right? So if you see a deal with pencils now, make it work. But there is, quote unquote, a lot of dry powder on the sidelines. And, if that doesn't get called, it might get put into something else. So I think when the market does swing back, it'll swing back very quickly. But I think the 2024 will be slower, but then 2025 and going to 2026 will be back to where you were in, 2016, 2017, 2018.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, then for everyone listening, just because I didn't mention at the beginning, I always try to, if you want to check out their website, it's at montgomerypartners.com. Common spelling. I'm sure you'll be able to find it on the internet. And thanks again, everyone. This has been Josh Tarr with The Real Angle. And thank you to Spencer, Brady, and Brady, though I really do want to call one of you Flounder. I really do. I will withhold that need. Thanks again, guys. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Josh. Take care.